Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Joining me in studio, ladies and gentlemen, I've had everybody from co-workers to Academy Award winners on this show, and friends, and because everybody goes to the movies, and everybody has an opinion. So it's one thing for me to go hunting after guests. It's one thing when they come and call saying, I really want to be on the show. And that's what my buddy Eric Studeville did. He's his wife, Stacy, works here at the station. He is the general manager at, is that the right title?
Yeah, that's
the general manager of Yats up in Carmel. So you've seen him. He's that guy. He's a really handsome guy that gives you drunken chicken. So, Eric, thank you for hanging out.
Thank you for having me, man.
So he had questions about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I've been, you know, the last few weeks you have heard me gripe as an old man. My mantra has been, you know, stop making movies about my record collection. Now, Eric's a younger man, a younger father than I, but I think he knows of the films I talk about. But what I've noticed, however, is while I've been griping about the biopics or biopics, if you say them that way, you know, while they've been starting to become a little routine, even though they've been pretty good, I've been seeing more music documentaries and they've been a little more satisfying. I believe next week, Echo from the Canyon is coming out on video. That's, of course, about the Laurel Canyon music sound of the 60s, which has a little bit about our main feature this week. We'll get to that in a second. I know there's going to be a film inspired by the music of Bruce Springsteen's last album. I'm guessing it might be a series of videos put together, but I'm not 100% on that. And that is put out by Warner Brothers and much, much more. And there's another film documentary, music documentary about somebody in Springsteen's life, which we'll get to in a little minute. So if you're wondering what I'm thinking about It Chapter 2, go somewhere else. Didn't see it. Have you seen it?
I have not seen it.
You have kids at home too, so that's a tough.
Yeah.
That's a tough sell.
No, and the kids naturally have innate fears of clowns to begin with. So
already?
Oh,
that's not going to help. Yeah.
So
I remember seeing the first one and liking it. I think it's wise of them. And I griped. I know I've griped about one film, one book, but this is actually Stephen King. So either make a 3.5 hour version of it, or I guess you split it into two parts because of the children aspect and then the grown-up aspect. So anyway, I will get around to it eventually, but that's not what the show is about. This week, there is a documentary called David Crosby, Remember My Name. Now, I've over the years grown a little more fond of Crosby, Stills, Nash, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. I'm still working on the solo work of each individual, except for Neil. And this time around, it's a pretty frank and at times brutally honest documentary about David Crosby as a person. It does cover the music scene. It does cover his, you know, his time with the Byrds, his very curt release from the Byrds, and then his time with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. And so you have all those old stories that old rockheads like me like to hear, and some backstage Babylon. He didn't like Jim Morrison or the Doors. He had a very unique way of getting dumped by Joni Mitchell in Song twice in front of people, relationships with, and friendships with everybody from Mama Cass to the guys in the band. And it also coincides with him going on the road, which in his, I guess, what, late 70s, doesn't want to do, but he has to. He even says early on, I'm the only one without a hit. And he's also very frank and has no filter. And that sometimes causes friendships, if not friction. Everything from talking about the war in the 60s to the other guys in the band who haven't talked to him in a couple years. So it coincides with, and I believe Cameron Crowe is a producer on this. So we have a lot of not necessarily new interviews, but there's stuff with Graham Nash. Oh, by the way, WFYI Small Studios guest Graham Nash. Go to smallstudios.wfyi.org. You'll see I'm not lying. But you see those interviews coincide with Crosby on a Couch. And he's not defensive. He knows he's got only himself to blame on this. And with a number of films, feature films, and documentaries that have started that have been popping up, I wish more of them were this frank. I mean, I say what you will about Bohemian Rhapsody. I know Sacha Baron Cohen would like to tell more, and Rocket Man told more, but probably not enough if it wasn't in a musical form. And you know, you could have, I think, done more with the music of the Beatles in Yesterday. And I did like the treatment of the music of Bruce Springsteen and Blinded by the Light, even though you guys should stop doing music about my record collection. Because eventually you're going to do a biopic or a biopic about a band or a person I like, and you're going to screw it up. And I'm not going to be happy about that. So anyway, if you're in for a good use, you know, a documentary with really good music and really honest talk, check out David Crosby, Remember My Name. On video this week, and this is the flip side of that to a certain degree, is a documentary called Clarence Clemons, Who Do You Think I Am? About Clarence Clemons, of course, saxophone player for Bruce Springsteen. And I was griping on last week's show, the Beatles documentary that didn't feature actual music of the Beatles. And there was a lot of old footage and music that was kind of canned. And this isn't that. Although it's closer to that, I think, to a certain degree, than David Crosby, Remember My Name. We find out through a lot of talking heads, lowercase t, lowercase h, of Clarence growing up. There's members of his family. There are former bandmates. Let's put it this way. Springsteen's not interviewed in this. And there's music. There's some live footage of Clarence doing the sax solo from Jungle Land, Bruce talking about Clarence on stage. You have Vinnie Lopez, who, of course, was on the first two albums, two and a half albums of Springsteen's career. I believe, oh, my gosh. So there's that. And also in interviews with Mike Appel, who, if you're a big Springsteen fan, was Springsteen's first manager. That relationship ended poorly with really long, drawn-out, and ugly lawsuits. And that's what kept Springsteen off, you know, the time off between Born to Run and Darkness on the Edge of Town. So I'm going to guess here that Bruce's contribution to the film was limited because of this. But the focus really is about Clemons as a person. And while we have a lot of people talking about him, and we see footage of him with the band, with his own band, and there's a big section of him going to China, trying to find a place where he's not recognized for anything, let alone his music, and then going to the Great Wall, playing a saxophone on the Great Wall, learning some cultural aspects of China, and trying to find himself. And there's a few moments, it looks like Clemons was sat down for maybe one session of filming. He says a few shaman-like philosophical things, but that's really about it. I wish we had heard more from Clemons himself as a subject matter. That's kind of the disappointment on this. I didn't mind so much. I understood why. Oh, yeah, and Clinton was in this. Bill, president, likes fellow saxophone player. Oh. So, yeah, I forgot about that. You know, Joe Walsh is, and that was the other, Nils Lofgren is also interviewed on this, who, you know, is a member of the E Street Band. So, anyway, if you're a Springsteen collector, you might want to check this out. But it should have given you a lot more. So that's about it for those. I want to shift gears before we talk with Eric a little bit. When was the last time, Eric, you were at a midnight movie?
Midnight movie?
Yes.
It's been a while.
Again, thanks, family.
Well, yeah. You know, there was a period in high school from age 17 to 18 where I did see Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday night for 1 year.
Where at?
It changed up. It was all here in Indianapolis. They had a showing in Speedway. There's a small theater there. Hollywood Barn Filmworks.
Oh, yeah.
The classic Hollywood Barn
Filmworks. I believe I went to Rocky Horror there once.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would do one a month and then a big one on Halloween.
So would they allot the props to you, or could you bring anything in?
They preferred, and this is how they sustained themselves, they would make their own goodie bags.
There you go.
And
I remember that.
Yeah, you pay a couple bucks, and you have all you need to participate.
Yeah, it's still a thing. Drink of water there. I remember a theater in my beloved hometown of Flint, Michigan. I want to say it was Genesee Valley, but or was it the other one? Anyway, they had no idea what they were getting themselves into, and guys brought stuff that had nothing to do with the film because Flint, Michigan boys are terrible. That's all. Not just me. But, yeah, and then I believe U of M Flint did it, and same thing, goodie bag, you know, that way. Stuff that was easy to pick up and clean. I was almost about the same way. In high school, there was a theater in Utica, Michigan, which was between Pontiac and Detroit. And it was a mall theater right off the highway, and they showed it every Friday and Saturday night. So if I was coming home from a concert or a ball game in Detroit and I wasn't exhausted, I would go.
Sure.
And the crowds varied. Sometimes you had a bunch of people that were really into it, and sometimes it was just me riffing, and you hear a bunch of suburban bros yelling homophobic slurs every time Tim Curry's on screen. I'm like, okay, that's that crowd.
Yeah, I'm not sure of that. I tried to do this as an adult. They had a showing at the IMA a couple years back.
Uh-huh.
And I'd memorized a lot of the offensive callbacks whenever I was a kid. And then that sticks in my craw. You know, it's just like any song lyric or anything. And so,
sure.
I'm going to go ahead and participate in all of my callbacks, but they're all just the most raunchy things that you can say in a public venue. And people are not expecting that. I think people in their mind, they think of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and they're expecting, you know, people throwing toast at the screen and, mm-hmm. you know, all of that fanfare. But I don't think they're really aware of how deep the the riffs, the callbacks really are.
Right, and I think there is when I was in high school, it was turned out to be a very valuable piece of equipment. But it was a two CD set of a live performance of Rocky Horror, which had, because by this time, this is what, mid 80s, it's been about a decade, so the riffs were established, and I'm thinking they recorded this in California. And it was the standard stuff that you would expect to hear. Every now and then you would hear, and I always give the example, growing up in Michigan, and then I went to see Rocky Horror at a theater in Fort Wayne. Mm-hmm. So this was my freshman year of college. And in Michigan, we had a bit when it got to be dinner time, we'd see the dome, and I would yell, "Hey, Pontiac Silverdome, who's playing? Monsters of Rock? Nah, just Meatloaf." Right? That's
classic.
A total regional thing.
Yes.
And I did that line and, you know, got some laughter, but some kid came up to me during the movie. He's like, "Where are you from?" And I went, "I'm outside Detroit, you know, Flint, outside Detroit, Michigan." "Oh." And then walked away. Just wanted to know where it came from.
Sure.
And so I wondered if over time, you know, there were certain specific location or regional riffs that came with a Rocky Horror. I'm sure there are. I have not found that article yet, so... No, will you take your kids to a midnight movie when they're old enough?
Well, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah,
for sure. But that's part of the deal, though. I don't know if they would want to be seen with me. If
they were by the time they get there?
Yeah, I mean, we have two things happening here. We have, you know, and hopefully we all meet in the middle.
Right.
You know, but there's like what I'm willing to, you know, what I want to show my kids and what I think is cool versus what they know is cool because they're actually young, you know. And
right.
The idea is for these two things to merge seamlessly. However, so I don't know if it will.
You're not sure if you're seeing My Little Pony in a few years at midnight with Maya?
Well, yeah, yeah, exactly.
Wait till you, and this will happen. How old is Maya now?
She just turned 9.
Yeah, you got a couple more years before it really kicks in. There will be the first time you take them to a movie and with a friend, and they will not sit with you.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah. That's Lynn and I had that experience a few years back, and I'm like, okay, that's fine. I always tell the story of what I call pop culture Atticus Finch. Emma was about 10. I want to say, yeah, it was probably about 10. And Keystone Arts, and I'll get the Keystone Arts Midnight listings in a minute, but they were showing Beetlejuice, and Emma really, really wanted to go, and I told her, if I look over at 12:30 and you're asleep, I'm not going to be happy. So I said, you got to watch a midnight movie at home, and if I know you can handle it, because it's basically not so much handling the movie, staying awake. Yeah. I said, if you pull that, you will do this. And by the way, she still says I haven't taken her to it, but, you know, she's a busy girl. But I was here at work, and we were staying at her grandparents for the weekend, and I got home about 10:30, and she goes, Dad, I want to take the test. And I always brought a bag of movies with me, and she picked Pulp Fiction.
All right.
So we waited until midnight, and then 2:45 a.m., she's like, oh, I really like that. One thing, though, what? And she took my hand and stood up and went, walk me through it. She wanted to know chronologically what happened.
That's another hour of
explanation. Right. So, yeah. So anyway, that's that. So, all right, with that in mind, ladies and gentlemen, if you have not heard, Keystone Arts have announced their midnight movies for the month of October. Get ready for this. October 4th and 5th. I need to revisit this because I don't remember really caring when it came out in 1987. I know it's a big deal. The Lost Boys, if you're into 80s. If you want vampires that are young and cute but don't sparkle, there's that. The big one, August 11th and 12th, and he will be in person both nights, Tommy Wiseau and The Room. So, yeah, I'll be playing the interview when it gets closer to that. So,
that's a big one.
Yep. October 18th and 19th, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Good to see at midnight on a big screen. And then finally, rounding up, this is also the most obscure of the four, and it's not that obscure, but interesting choice, and I'm glad he picked it. I probably haven't seen this since I saw it in the theaters. October 25th and 26th, John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness.
Okay.
Donald Pleasance and Jameson Parker and Lisa Blount. So anyway, congrats. So, yeah, get out to a midnight movie. Yes, any yutz can watch a midnight movie at home. It's a special case to go see it in the theater, so go check that out. Now, at the Tibbs Drive-In for this weekend, yes, on screen. So, last time you went to a drive-in?
That's
also on the list.
The original Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, okay.
Okay, yeah. And this is before I had children.
Right, so that's another one to put on the list. Mm-hmm. Screen one at the Tibbs, both parts of It, of course. Screen two, Angel Has Fallen and Ready or Not. So two violent R-rated movies. Okay. I always try to find the connection. Screen three, you have It Chapter 2 and Annabelle. Sure.
Scary.
Same studio? Yeah. Screen four, Don't Let Go and Good Boys. Both rated R, both same studio. I don't know. Okay. Well, that's there. Over at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville on the 6th and 7th, at the time you read this, Dusk Till Dawn movies. This is, I guess, both nights. It Chapter 2, Friday the 13th, Part 3. Don't know if it's in 3D. Sorry. Third film, The Burning. That's an obscure. This is early 80s. It's also, if I remember right, also kids in camp getting, late camp getting killed. Which, if I believe, I'm going to have to type this in. hot typing action here at Film Sociology. Yeah, a young Jason Alexander is in this. Tony Mayim, yeah, Leah Ayers, Larry Joshua. Yeah, this is one that's it's of the post slasher movies, post Halloween, post Friday the 13th. This is one of note. So anyway, that is happening. So you have It Chapter 2, Friday the 13th 3, The Burning, and then the fourth film, Annabelle Comes Home. So if you're into scary movies all night, go to Shelbyville. And finally, at IU, 7 o'clock on Friday the 6th, Love and Basketball. At 10 o'clock, the 30th anniversary screening of Pet Sematary. Saturday, September 7th. Ah, I just talked about this film last week, the documentary Cassandro, the Exotico, a Mexican lucha libre wrestler who is basically the Liberace of lucha libre. Okay. So wanted the film to be longer, wanted more wrestling action for my taste. But the fact that you had a an openly gay man in the kind of macho world of professional wrestling, mm-hmm. and I wish they had tackled that subject a little bit more. There's a lot of footage of him driving and going to and from gigs and training sessions. But I they could have dug a little deeper for that, for my taste, and maybe had more other wrestlers talking about his importance. But wrestling documentary about wrestling on the border in Mexico and Texas, I'm good with that. So that's at 4 o'clock on Saturday. Lost in Translation at 7 o'clock. Sunday, September 8th, Cassandro is being shown again at 1 o'clock, and then Selma at 4 o'clock. Monday, September 9th. Who Will Write Our History, a documentary from 2018 at 7 o'clock. And then recently added Thursday the 12th, The Farewell at 7 p.m. And then Friday the 13th, no, not that, Fast Color at 7 o'clock, The Farewell at 10 o'clock. So, and then Saturday the 14th, Gordon and Patty at 4 o'clock as part of the CineKids International Children's Film Series, as well as Running the Screen, films directed by women. And then directors Crystal Z. Campbell and Madeline Hunt Ehrlich are scheduled to be present for the 7 p.m. screenings of Gorilla Means War, A Quality of Light, and Spit on the Broom at 7 o'clock Saturday the 14th. All right. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here at WFYI.org. Eric Studeville is hanging out with me, just picking brains and talking shop and, you know, films with your kids and everything, that sort of thing. Now, part of the reason why Eric was asked to be on the show, and I appreciate that, but you wanted to talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Have you talked Stacey's ear off about this already?
Well, I have. Okay. Yeah. But I can only go so far.
I understand.
Yeah. So immediately, yeah, we saw the film. I think she enjoyed it. I loved it. And we riffed on it, you know, to the best of our ability. And I loved it so much, and she ran out of things to say about it, so I had to see it a second time in order to...
How many days after?
It would have been the next day.
Okay.
Okay, but circumstance postponed it for a couple weeks.
That's all right. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely.
You remember, have you ever done the, you go see a movie, and then you turn right around and go see it again?
I haven't done that, but there are a couple of movies that I've seen that I basically shouted out in spirit anyway to the projectionist, play it again. Yeah, one of those being another Tarantino movie, Kill Bill 1, mm-hmm. where I was just like, I'm ready to do that one again. And then Linklater's School of Rock. I was ready to continue to live in that world
okay.
for a while longer too.
I saw The Usual Suspects and then walked out and then saw it again.
Yeah.
But that was 25 years ago. So, yeah, life and work and family and stuff sometimes gets in the way of our cinematic whims.
Absolutely.
So you saw it a couple days later.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And what any difference from the first time you had witnessed it?
There's a lot of differences, actually. And it wasn't a couple days later. It was a couple of weeks later.
Oh, a couple weeks later. Okay.
And in that meantime, I had discovered a podcast via Apple Podcasts. The name of the show was You Must Remember This, and You Must Remember This is a collection of single episodes and a few multi-part episodes and stories on Hollywood stories. Okay. So one of them being there's like a multi-part on the McCarthy era blacklist and everybody who was blacklisted, all the players involved, the context around that. So on this podcast, they did a 10 or 12 part installments for Charles Manson's Hollywood.
Okay.
Everything leading up to the events of August 1969, which Once Upon a Time in Hollywood concerns itself with.
Yep.
So in this meantime, I was listening to this podcast and kind of like deriving more knowledge and context about the film that wasn't exactly explicitly given to you in the movie itself.
Okay.
And so I feel like in that meantime, I was kind of educating myself on the players, the various actors who are surrounding that movie and making it up. So I felt like when I went back in the second time, I had a lot more working knowledge of what I was actually seeing, in terms of that outside of the Rick and Cliff storyline, everything surrounding Sharon Tate.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Cool. We were talking off air. So I saw it about 3 days after I got back from Scotland. So I was very lucky. I didn't read anything about the review. I didn't read any reviews. Therefore, I knew nothing about the ending.
Yeah.
And without giving away, not going to give away a whole lot. I'll try not to give anything away.
Yeah.
But what was interesting was, all right. Well, some folks have complained about the length. I didn't mind the length. I didn't mind hanging out in that world for 2 hours and 40-some-odd minutes.
That was a blast.
I love that aspect of Hollywood. I'm fascinated by it. Back when, if you were in movies and you went down to TV, it was like a step down in your career.
Yes.
That's not quite the case these days. It's a little more open. So him tackling that, the kind of mysterious aspect of Brad Pitt's character.
Yes.
There's a little, he is absolutely, devoted to Leonardo DiCaprio's friend, even though he's got one giant black spot about him.
Yes.
Throughout. And then the treatment of Sharon Tate, and I've said, I think I'm not the first one to say, it's almost a silent performance from Robbie.
Very much so.
But, and it's not a, I want to word this carefully. It's not, I don't think he's belittling Tate. He just doesn't make Sharon Tate into one of his Quentin Tarantino characters. She's not a chatty girl like Mia in Pulp Fiction or any of the girls in Death Proof. So, and her watching the movie, the Dean Martin film, there's this great sense of joy watching herself and seeing people enjoy the work, that sort of thing, which adds to this sense overview of dread that's happening. And then we get to how are they going to handle the moment, capital T, capital M, and I'm just going to leave it there. Now, that being said, and this will be a big hint if you know his films, my wife had not seen Inglourious Basterds or Django Unchained. So she had no idea what was coming.
Okay.
Emma and I had, so when the moment happens, it made sense.
Sure.
That's pretty vague enough, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
I agree with you about the dread that settled
it's like
with me over
this movie. Midsummer and that have been the two films where it's, oh my, and it's mostly bright and sunny, but oh God, there's going to, bad things are coming.
It's, it's interesting. When I walked out, when I left the movie the second time, I stopped into the restroom and a couple of younger men were discussing the movie that they had just seen, and they were both trying to suss out amongst themselves what actually happened as far as like the Manson murders were concerned.
Right.
So I mean, everybody knows who Charles Manson is, but they may not necessarily.
Well, that's what I mean. I'm going to be in the old curmudgeon, and you're the slightly younger curmudgeon. But I wondered, Emma knew Charles Manson by name, but that was about it. So I remember.
I've grown up with this. I remember Helter Skelter when it was a TV miniseries in the late 70s. So I've known the name and that piece of history for a long, long time. We were mentioning, I was mentioning David Crosby earlier. I'm wondering how many folks that are slightly older than your daughter and my daughter's age, if they know the basis of the song Ohio.
Okay. Yeah, unlikely.
So anyway, I'm sorry. But no, so these young guys are trying to figure this out.
Yeah, and they're trying to figure it out.
Right, what are they, like 20s?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Okay.
Yeah, and whenever, you know, when I say that they, you know, that everybody knows Manson, maybe everybody knows his name as they know the name of any other famous serial killer.
Okay.
But they were trying to suss out exactly what the nature of his crimes were and how they related to the film that they had just taken
in. Which, you know, that trial was covered.
Right. But it's interesting because somebody, you know, of an older generation, somebody who grew up with, you know, within the context of this movie, can take that baggage, that knowledge into the film with them, mm-hmm. and they can work with that, which would, you know, and in my case, I wasn't there firsthand, but I was aware enough of the crimes that took place on Cielo Drive to know what was coming.
Sure.
A lot of people are going to see that flick, see the Hollywood, and not have any idea of how this is supposed to play out. And I think that's going to work pretty well for them. Although I think a lot of, like, perhaps some people are going to find the movie to be a little aimless in that sense because they don't know, like, what we're leading up to necessarily.
Sure, sure.
And so I found it amusing whenever I was these guys were trying to, like, figure it out, you know.
Did you chime in or did you – or actually, it was the bathroom. Don't talk in
the
restroom.
Yeah, absolutely.
How dare you talk to me while I'm washing my hands. Well, and other things, but we won't get into that.
Hey, by the way, your reading of this was all wrong.
Because that's what you need, a cinematic debate in the toilet.
Yeah, but no, I was just more amused by, you know, they're discussing and they're trying to work it out.
Right.
I felt like, so what that tells me is, like, they cared. They
Good.
Cared about this character. They cared about the movie they just saw.
If you wind up, well, one, discussing it, and two, going to do research, even if you're, like, for instance, with certain documentary filmmakers, if you go to look up something just to see if they're wrong and full of crap, then mission accomplished on their part, whether you agree with it or not. So cool on that. We were also talking about, this past weekend, I bought the soundtrack. And if it is out, it is. When does it come out on vinyl?
I believe it comes out next month.
Okay,
but it could be. Yeah. I believe it's October.
I'm old, and I bought it on CD. So I'm.
Well, you can get it right now. You can listen to Spotify on Spotify.
Well, I know
if
they're.
Like.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. No, except for the Blues House Party. But
of course.
So, for those and I have every Tarantino soundtrack. Uh-huh. It's you know the first in the 90s. It was the first hip mix disc, and. In this one, what makes it different than the others, and I remember breaking this to Emma, and she was cool with it. There's no dialogue. His soundtracks are famous for having little snippets of dialogue. Instead, we get a slew of radio spots that you hear in the film from the LA rock stations that he listened to, film trailers. Oh, look, there's that out there in the back. If you can hear the police siren in the background, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show. We're not giving away secrets. But... Of course, it's the not obvious choice of music from Tarantino. It's a lot of obviously late 60s pop. That's as I made the realization, nobody I don't think that's whose music appears in the film plays at Woodstock. So it's not probably the biggest bands in this are Simon and Garfunkel and Deep Purple.
Right.
But nothing of an obvious choice, you know, Paul Revere and the Raiders, and I believe the Box Tops are among others.
Mm-hmm.
But it's songs you're familiar with. They're not played 10 times a day on oldies radio. They are now. But some groups, I think there's a couple groups there in particular I have not heard of. I believe there's a Latin kind of jazzy instrumental piece that I'm going to find out more about this band because of that.
Sure.
So anyway, your take on the soundtrack, because it's a fun listen.
I think the soundtrack is terrific, and I feel I love hearing the interstitial radio ads. In the film itself, the radio station, I feel, kind of takes on kind of a role of a narrator in a
sense. To a certain degree, yeah.
You know, as we're being whisked from, you know, various parts of L.A., you know, in these great sweeping shots of everybody driving awesome cars with their hair flying in the breeze. It's very carefree and very awesome. And you're hearing terrific ads, and especially you're not paying that much attention to them when you're watching the film because there's a lot going on. But when you're driving in your own car and you're hearing an advertisement for Tanya tanning butter.
Yeah, it's cocoa butter and cocoa milk, I think, and that's it.
Don't forget the lava smoke.
Oh, that's right, lava smoke, right. And that's that. You rub that on your skin, and you'll get – the FDA chimed in, I'm sure, right after, but yeah.
There's nothing between you and the sun but the Tanya tanning butter.
And your skin doctor within a few years.
See, that's gold. This is terrific stuff.
That's a great ad. Oh, I forgot. Other big bands, that young upstart musician from Michigan known as Bob Seger.
Bob Seger.
The original Ramblin' Gamblin' Man is like track two on this. And Emma saw me cracking up because I grew up in Michigan. When we are born, I was trying to explain to her, this is another one. I said, you know how Indiana gushes over John Mellencamp? And she went, no. I went, honey, Indiana gushes over John Mellencamp, just like New Jersey gushes over Springsteen. Michigan gushes over Bob Seger and, to a certain degree, Ted Nugent and Kid Rock.
Sure, okay.
I like to think when I was born, there was a Seger album put in my crib, if not Grand Funk Railroad. But anyway.
That was, that Seger track, I hadn't heard that.
Really?
And no, because my experience with Seger is pretty much limited to Risky Business.
Oh, God.
All-time rock and roll.
Yeah.
Or filtered through Metallica doing
Turn the Page.
Turn the
That's
Page.
Right.
I mean, like, so, like, a lot of my, like, Seger is kind of secondhand Seger, I guess. And also, when you get, like, enough people kind of, like, rehashing original ideas, you know, like, it kind of becomes passé, right?
I would say, if you were going, I think he had a really solid streak of albums to about the early 80s. I think maybe I can't remember if Shame on the Moon or Against the Wind. I saw him on the Like a Rock tour in 86. This was when he sold the song for a commercial.
Yeah.
For the truck. And that was a huge deal in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one, it was like Springsteen in Detroit. He played at Joe Louis Arena. Georgia Satellites opened. He did six shows. And it was one of those, in one time, young folks, we had to wait outside a mall and get tickets, like outside JCPenney. This was, I believe, there was this and Monsters of Rock where I stayed out all night to get tickets. And it was one of those, like, whenever you got up at line, whatever show was available, that's where you were going. And I was like, I got the show number 4.
Okay.
Because that's how it worked. So, but great show. I still remember, with the exception of Kathmandu and American Storm, and don't ask me why. Another sidetrack, folks. Let's not gripe what the musicians don't play. Let's celebrate what they do play.
Wow.
That being said, except for those two songs, hit after hit after
Did
hit.
Did he
after
write
hit.
Anything besides a hit? As you're going through
album tracks,
I was forgetting. Yeah, as you mentioned, Kathmandu and Like a Rock. I'm just like, wow.
You tell you what, go look
through
up,
the ages.
Yeah, go look up Bob Seger on YouTube. Somewhere in rock radio right now, it's being played. Somewhere in the world right now, a bar band is butchering his stuff. That's not a bad legacy to have.
I think that's what. And I think that's why I really liked Ramblin' Gamblin' Man. It sounded like some old like Mitch Ryder, kind of thing. Like it just sounded like a different impression of Bob Seger than I had made for myself.
It's funny because you mentioned old time rock and roll, which is a song I never have to hear ever again.
Nope.
And it's been under the clutches of pop culture and Madison Avenue. Like a Rock, we already discussed, is kind of like that. And anyway, if you get a chance, go back through some of this. You'll recognize like couple dozen tunes over the years. So anyway, that's if anything else, if this film and this soundtrack makes you look into more Bob Seger, film sociology has done its job.
Yeah.
I've also told, I was saying earlier, Emma is now in a deep dive of late 60s pop. And there's somebody who's created a Spotify account based on the soundtrack and, of course, stuff that's related to similar you know, in our record store era, music from the era.
Sure.
I remember when they put out a second album soundtrack for The Big Chill, because I think there was like two more songs from the film and everything else was like, yeah, there wasn't in the movie.
Yeah.
You're just padding Motown. Thanks a lot. So anyway, you can now get that in Spotify form.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I've mentioned a few of the films that, because I remember the AV Club did a list of some pop culture references from, you see images of the TV show The FBI, mm-hmm. and Mannix, and there's a shot of Robert Goulet singing MacArthur Park.
Yes.
So, and it's explaining why they had an idea why he put it there and why it's there. Three in the Attic is a film trailer that's in that's on the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. I know he makes reference. There's another one for the Rod Steiger film, The Illustrated Man. Yes, based on the novel, the short story of
Bradbury.
Ray Bradbury. Mm-hmm. Really mixed bag. It's a strange thing to watch. And this was Rod Steiger had won Best Actor 2 years prior for In the Heat of the Night. And so he, you know, kind of parlayed his fame. I remember Roger Ebert once said, "If you're nominated for an Oscar, you're guaranteed one film. If you win, you're guaranteed three." And I believe one of his three was Illustrated Man.
Okay,
Illustrated Man, The General, which I believe was on a marquee in the film. And what I remember about that film is, it's a soldier, it's a general in the army who's dealing with his closeted homosexuality. Mm-hmm. In a major Warner Brothers film for 1968. And then I believe his third film was a very expensive international failure called Waterloo, where he played Napoleon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's up there. I've told a little bit to Emma about Sergio Corbucci, which if you see the film, Leonardo DiCaprio's character is offered, because he's washed up in movies, he's now doing TV and pilots, but he gets an offer to star in westerns and spy movies in Italy, which a lot of actors did. Everyone from Clint Eastwood, Burt Reynolds, George Kennedy, a number of actors went over to Italy to make movies. Peter Graves and Sergio Corbucci was the man. He directed the original Django, the one with Franco Nero, and that spawned thousands of imitators. He also did The Great Silence. Navajo Joe with Burt Reynolds is a get drunk and fun, bad film to watch. But anyway, he's referred to in the film as Italy's second greatest spaghetti Western director, obviously behind Sergio Leone. So, sure. You know, if it gets more people to check out Corbucci's stuff, I'm down with that as well.
This is something I want to ask you about as we're watching Hollywood. We keep cutting to other films that DiCaprio's character has starred in. So one of them being like the 14 Fists of McCluskey.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to ask you, with like your knowledge of these films, how period specific these cuts were for you? Like, did these work whenever you see like the, you know, the color, you know, the gradient
okay.
of the film?
Well, the McCluskey thing is, again, not giving away a lot. There's film footage of him in this World War II action film where he puts a flamethrower to a bunch of Nazi officers.
Very, very Inglorious Bastards.
Yeah, it totally is. And that's the film. It looks like an outtake of Inglorious Bastards. Mm-hmm. That's one problem. But and it's a scene that would later, well, it foreshadows. I'll leave it at that. I was trying to figure out, is this a grittier version of, say, The Dirty Dozen? And I know Inglorious Bastards, because Inglorious Bastards, the Italian film from the 70s with Bo Svenson and Fred Williamson, was a cheaper knockoff of The Dirty Dozen. It was, a bunch of military criminals who have to, you know, go over enemy lines or die trying, or else you go and get hanged in prison. So that was a part of Quentin's Inglorious Bastards. Mm-hmm. It was not a complete, it was just one aspect of that film. There was a kind of a Dirty Dozens feel to it with Brad Pitt's characters and all the soldiers. But you also had the woman in part of the resistance with the movie theater, and the brilliant Christoph Waltz. So it was it was more than I think a lot of us were expecting. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of story, but but I also thought, man, that's Hollywood at that time, and because they don't say exactly when McCluskey happens.
Sure.
No. So, but if you're thinking about the timeline, mm-hmm. I'm probably thinking mid-60s, yeah. mid to late 60s, because violence in cinema took a big turn in 1967 with Bonnie and Clyde. This film is set in 69. So it could be 67. You have Bonnie and Clyde in 67. And then really for me, the next one is The Wild Bunch mm-hmm. in 69. But films, you know, and of course the collapse of the studio system, but independent films became, and films toward the youth market became a little darker, a little grittier. That's why it was fun watching, those films that were kind of stuck in the middle. Mm-hmm. And I think, McCluskey is sort of like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it didn't look anything like The Dirty Dozen. It did look like an Inglourious Basterds outtake.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, and later in the film, we cut to one of his to an outtake of Rick in one of the Italian films.
Oh, the spy film.
Yeah.
Oh, that cracks me up. Yeah, that's cute. I mean, it's kind of low, dimly lit, and it's him in the car, and there's a jump over a bridge with a nice moment
right.
to say, "Here's Brad," and those kind of they in Italy. There's Mike Malloy, who's been a guest on this show, has a very fun film documentary. If you can look for it, called Eurocrime. And these were the films, the mob and cop films done in Italy in the 1970s because of the success of The Godfather and then, of course, of Dirty Harry and Bullet and The French Connection. Italy was kind of a bandwagon industry.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
If a Western did well, you got a slew of spaghetti Westerns. And if these films, they got a slew of those. And they didn't really have permits in okay. Italy. They just kind of shot as they pleased. Now, they had to pay the local neighborhood constituency. Yeah, that's a word. You kind of know what I mean. Certain neighborhood groups, certain organizations, just to get your film shot in there. Neighborhood,
yeah,
that sort of thing. But there wasn't, I was talking earlier with a friend about the French Connection, and I was talking with my buddy Andy, and we were talking about the famous chase scene in the French Connection, yep. which they really just didn't apply for permits. They just kind of went out there and shot it.
Shot around.
We don't condone such behavior, but it's thrilling to watch. So
true guerrilla filmmaking.
Yeah, guerrilla with a U, folks. I don't know. So yeah, there's that.
Yeah.
Shifting gears a little bit. So you and Stacey have been together how long?
Oh, wow.
Now we're going down this path.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Are you asking when our anniversary is?
No, it's not the date. It's not the newlywed game.
No, 14 years.
14 years.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first movie you saw with Stace?
Oh,
Watch, she'll know the answer.
Actually, I do.
Okay. All right.
We saw A Mighty Wind.
Really?
Yeah. That was our first movie.
Stace, did you tell me this? Wow. Did it went well?
It went great.
Obviously, you're
in fact,
still here.
When we, like on our wedding day, the first song we danced to a few songs. We like music a lot. But A Kiss from a Rose, Kiss from the Rose was like our wedding song. You know, the one that Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara
right.
duet
on. I was waiting, Seal? No.
Yeah, no. I think that's the name of the.
A Kiss at the End of the Rainbow.
That's right.
It. Sorry. Whew. Crisis averted.
She can't hear this.
No, she'll just fine.
Okay.
That's cool. That's really cool. We are fans of the Chris Guest film, so we've got to experience that one. Biggest argument you two have had over a film. Now, I know there's a certain filmmaker I can't bring up around your lovely wife. Lars von Trier.
Oh, she hates him.
Yes, I know. I believe the term "F this guy" is her catchphrase.
She feels very manipulated by his works.
You think?
Yeah. You know, I can't say that I blame her.
No. I tend to see Lars's films by myself.
Yeah. And It's an unpopular opinion. Like, I don't love everything this man has done, and I don't think I love that man either. But there are
you don't have to tie him and share a calendar with him. You just got to spend 2 hours, 2.5 hours of his work.
I think he's made some undeniably memorable moments, some powerful moments.
Yes. And good, bad, and ugly.
Absolutely. But I like that. I like a film or a filmmaker that has, you know, in extreme views or is a very polarizing, you know, filmmaker. Mm-hmm. The provocative filmmaking, I think, is what I'm after. I just want to have an opinion either
sure.
way, you know, like
it's better. I think it's better to go big and maybe not succeed or crash and burn. Mm-hmm. I would rather take that than a decade of meh.
Having said that, I haven't seen his latest movie, The House That Jack Built. I saw the trailer for it.
I did, too.
I don't think I want to see this film. I don't know. I'm afraid.
I'm going to watch it alone.
Okay.
I will say this, because it was on Netflix for a while, and then it kind of disappeared. See, this is why you should own physical copies. But I don't know if I want a physical copy of The House That Jack Built. I'll give you an example, and I'm going to ask you the same thing. There are films that you watch when you know the family is out of the house.
Oh, absolutely.
One of the great examples I used was Lynn and Emma were gone for an entire afternoon, and I watched both parts of Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac.
I've done that.
Not fun, folks. Not fun at all. It's Uma Thurman's great for the.
That's a great scene.
It's a great scene. And Jamie Bell's in it. It's a really – and the woman, Charlotte Gainsbourg?
Gainsbourg,
mm-hmm. Who should have a medal because she's worked several times with Lars von Trier. I mean this with all due respect. I wish she'd do a rom-com. I want her to do something easy. She's put herself through such agony working with that man.
Sure. You know, well, she does have she records kind of – almost synth pop kind of
okay.
album. So I feel like she has this outlet, you know.
That's her outlet, Lars. Holy cow! The music is her
synth
outlet.
Pop, light music. Her disco music is like her, okay. Her escape from whatever.
Well, good.
Lars put her through.
All right.
Well, I've only watched that film the once.
Me too.
And it's only going to be the once, I think. However, that movie. It has lived in my head ever
sure.
since seeing it. So, again, like I can't deny like it's, you know, it's indelible
okay.
aspects.
Have you had a cinematic argument with the lovely?
Over that particular movie?
No, just in general.
Just in general. You know, we tend to watch and enjoy mostly the same things.
That's okay if you don't. I mean, or can't remember right away. Do you remember the first film in the theater that you took Maya to?
We took her to Toy Story 3.
Ooh.
That was more for us, Stacy and I. She, you know, my daughter was still like in her car seat, you know, and it was one of those kind of, you know, a film appreciator with children, like the last thing I want to do is ruin the experience for anybody else. So I think we picked
it's a tough call.
Like a later showing, and we, you know, sat in the back of the theater in case my kid
right.
melted down.
Right, you scoot out immediately. On behalf of the patrons, thank you for being
absolutely.
That considerate and thoughtful.
You know, this is something that I've come to love that I can now. reserve my seats in advance, you know, because there have been a few shows where I want to take my kids to, and you do have some leeway in children's movies, you know, where it's expected that your kid is probably not going to sit in the seat the whole time. And
right.
May
oh,
talk
yeah.
through it.
That was Racing Stripes with Emma, first film.
Yeah.
On my lap, in the chair, on my lap, in the chair. Yeah.
And you have to be able to, like, to bail at a moment's notice
yep.
if that's the
case. You're like De Niro in Heat.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've had to like bail out on like the most, you know, innocuous of movies, you know, just because, you know, a movie theater is a dark, loud place,
yep.
and my kids panic.
Stacy tells me the story, and I've actually shared this, so she's let me do that. But there was, and it's a great example. She told me Maya was scared of the wolves in Zootopia.
Yes,
but that was because part of it was because it was in the theater, but she was able to watch it in the comfort and safety
of her house.
Yes.
So that I think that's a great example. I think the sensory, the experience, how you're feeling at that time, because did you get up late and watch scary movies as a kid, unbeknownst to the parents, that sort of thing? Because I think there's one thing to do it in your house, because then you have a whole bed and covers and sure. things like that. But if you're in a theater, you're kind of stuck.
Yes.
You know, unless you really have a meltdown and you tell parents you want to go home, or parents take you. But mm-hmm. You're in your house. So unless it's don't show them Black Christmas or no. When a Stranger Calls, you know, where that cliche comes from. But yeah. But you're at least safely in your own home.
Agreed. For me, one of an early film going experience I had was my mother took me to Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Oh,
which has a couple right in succession of some really difficult scenes. The one that got me,
the heart.
No, I didn't make it that far.
The monkey brains?
No, I made it that far. Right before the heart
Kate
scene.
Kate Capshaw screening? No.
They're trapped in this room with spikes that are impending spikes, and they're trying to find a way out of it.
Yeah.
Kate Capshaw is trying to, she's screaming, she's terrified by all the bugs, you know, and
that'll do it.
They're just going to die. So I panicked, left the theater. Mom let me go. You know, she took me home. And fortunately, you know, this is right around, you know, this is, mid, late 80s. And I'm pretty sure we were able to get that on VHS not too long after. And I remember being able to watch that movie at home mm-hmm. and watch that scene, go through it, and conquer that scene. And I felt like that was, something that you know, because that, again, almost in that Lars von Trier kind of trip, this is like a thing that lived in my head, you know, like these images, and then just to be able to kind of like get some power over it. And
you're the kids in It.
Yeah just to like get that out of your system and be able to like proceed and be like, that wasn't so bad after all.
Now, have you had, on a similar note, film that you were scared of as a child that you watched older and you went, I was scared of that? I'll give you an example. So sure. Mine was, because I was like, you get up late, you know, mom and dad are asleep, and you turn on, you know, the only thing on is the TV, the glow of the screen, the glass screen, ladies and gentlemen. And it was a Vincent Price film called Madhouse. Mm. And it was a Saturday night, and he's a horror movie star whose wife, his fiance, and other people in his life start getting bumped off, and it's looking like he's the culprit, suspect. And everything about it was unnerving. I was probably 8 or 9, maybe 10.
Yeah.
But it's the, you know, you're in by yourself, you watch something, you're focused on it, and it's, you know, kind of scary. And then while I was watching this, our cat jumped on my lap.
Oh.
Lights come on in my dad's room. I'm like, oh, God. And, you know, got marched to bed and everything. So that was that. And then cynical movie teenage boy, they're out there. Watched it again, and they were like, oh, that's scary. What are you talking about? Now, of course, I've reached the third stage where I'm a fan of late 60s, early 70s Vincent Price. He's doing what he does. That's what he's expected to do. And there's a certain camp level, but it's enjoyable.
Yes.
So I guess that's whether you're at stage two or stage three, it doesn't matter. You're younger than me. It's fine. So, but is there something that you've watched and went, oh, that was slightly embarrassing?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it went that direction. The one, another one that I can remember is I think my dad rented RoboCop,
the first one,
which is an insanely violent movie.
Did he know going? Because
I don't think he did.
I don't think any of us knew.
No,
because unless you were a big studier of Paul Verhoeven before that going in, which.
Nope.
None of us really were. We just, you know, the title kind of explains it. It's a robot policeman, and I think nobody was expecting a satire,
right?
And sometimes satire is hard to read. And two, yeah, it's probably the bloodiest film of 1987.
Right.
Holy cow!
So there's an like one of the beginning scenes where, you know, the robot ED-209
very good.
Thank you. Just completely shoots up a boardroom.
Literally
with hole. I mean, literally holes in things and people.
I've never seen anything so graphic.
Right? Because think about prior to that, Clint Eastwood, Schwarzenegger, even the Wild Bunch, you know, which, you know, the squibs were in slow motion, yeah, and the technology had gotten different, gotten better. But, you know, it was before computer graphics came in and you could, you know, you could fill Robert Patrick with a hole and then the liquid stuff just kind of comes in. But yeah, yeah, it just, it felt like they were squibs the size of melons, mm-hmm, just on people.
Yeah, yeah. Have you heard the podcast, How Did This Get Made?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wait, no. What am I thinking? I Was There, Too. I Was There, Too.
Oh, I've heard of it, but I've not.
So the premise of I Was There, Too is they try to find an extra from classic movies just to kind of give you a sense of what was going on there. So one of their guests, they had an extra from RoboCop, somebody who had been, like squibbed up during the production.
Oh, my gosh.
And
how many?
It was plus 50, like
James Caan in The yeah. Godfather.
Yeah, and I think it was specifically the board executive that met his demise. And I remember finding that pretty entertaining. But yeah, it was, you know, again, it's more kind of a going back and conquering like the fear of, you know, sure, the initial impression. But in the case of RoboCop, you know, as that movie progresses, like, it doesn't relent, you know, like,
right,
it just gets worse and worse throughout it. And so, I don't know, there's this kind of a, you want to be able to, you know, to say you've done it, you know, you complete it. And that was a big deal for me, too. Like, my parents, you know, I was not raised on slasher films. We are not a gore family. So, like, right, I was always very sheltered against that kind of thing anyway. So to eventually get to a point where I could, like, you know, survive a quote unquote, you know, scary or violent movie, you know, became like kind of like something I strove for as I was when I was in my, you know, self-involved movie geekdom of teenage years.
I'm,
you know,
right. You're wrong.
Yeah.
Also, this podcast. No, I'm kidding.
Well, there's like a lot of like self-education that has to take place.
Yep.
And you're going to see things. So we were talking about midnight movies and
yeah,
Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, which in my head, even the title is telling you everything you are going to face in this,
yep,
film.
Yep.
Absolutely terrified to do it. But you know its place in kind of like the film history canon, I guess.
Well, and I think
so you have to do it.
Yeah,
some
that's
point.
Something where a younger, and you know, and I tried to do this with my kid, and it sounds like you're going to do that with yours eventually. But yeah, you have to think about the historical aspect. When I told Emma, you know, the first film that scared the hell out of me was Jaws. I was 5. It scared the crap out of me.
Sure.
And then I showed it to her a few years ago, and the little hipster said something. Well, I could see how that would have scared you when you were 5. It was okay, you know. So, but you have to, but the historical aspect of it. So, mm-hmm, we mentioned I went through a period where I was showing her car chase films like Bullet and The French Connection, yeah, The Road Warrior, and I was doing the, you know, banging my fist on the podium of, you know, real stunts done by real stunt men and women. And this is, you know, Michelle Yeoh jumping the motorcycle on the moving train and, yeah, a super cop, you know, that stuff. So she gets a little bit of historical aspect on it. When, yeah, I kind of talked her through some of the movies that were mentioned in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, mm-hmm, and, of course, offered to watch them with her anytime. And she's like, no, I'm good.
Yeah.
She watched this the 4 Leone Westerns. Well,
yes,
except for Fistful of Dynamite. But she's watched The Three Clints and Once Upon a Time in the West. So,
what's her
nothing.
Take on those?
She loved them. There,
yeah,
was, this was, we were still living here.
Yeah.
But this was at her Hannah Montana phase. And this was also, you will hopefully go through this as well. They will pick up homages to other things, but they don't know.
Yeah.
And in the case of this, it was, it was a squirt gun fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did the music, you know, not Sergio Leone, but Sergio Leone sounding music with, you know, vocalization and bells and whistles and guitars and,
yep,
extreme close-ups of the eyes and the hands. And she goes, that she told me this, and she goes, it looked like one of your movies, but I couldn't tell. And then I said, it was Sunday morning, and I said, that sounds like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, what every father wants to hear. Do you own it? And I went, yeah. Can we watch it? And I I almost burst into tears. I was so excited. So we grabbed it. We got 2/3 of the way through it. And the look on Lynn's face when she came out of the bedroom and heard us doing this. And then we watched it the last hour later. And then I showed her Fistful of Dollars. Then I showed her for a few dollars more. And then she took my box set and took it to her room.
Oh.
And she would just put it on. And then we watched, I explained the Oh My God, It's Henry Fonda shot in Once Upon a Time in the West. Mm-hmm. And I said to her earlier, and it's true, every shot in a Sergio Leone film, you could print and frame as a piece of art.
Oh, yeah,
and so I think part of it was that she wanted to look and see if that was true. She's like, yeah, Dad, these are beautifully sculpted, framed images. So, yeah, I'd like to revisit those with her, hopefully before she goes away. But we will see. But, yeah, she likes Spy Kids.
Yeah.
And so that got her on the Bond films.
Oh, okay.
And because she likes Scooby-Doo, which that's another podcast for another time. Overrated. But I said to her, okay, that was her introduction to the whodunit. Not really, but kind of.
Yeah.
And I said, well, how would you like to see a whodunit, but you know who does it at the beginning and how they're going to get caught? And that's how I got her hooked on Columbo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So anyway, there's a lot of references and a lot of kids' shows, kids' programming, if they're smart.
Yeah.
You know, if you're doing something for the folks, if you're something for the adults in the room to watch as well, that will help. So I'm hoping you have that day with your two kids.
Yeah, yeah. Now my youngest son, who just turned 5,
how's he doing?
He's doing great. Oh yeah. My God, he's a handful. He's a lot of fun. And he's at a great stage. Can't, you know, he's so energetic. And the film I introduced to him 2 weeks ago, and I had to be very strategic about this,
yep,
was the original Karate Kid.
And, really?
Which is a film I loved growing up. And okay. I think it's a terrific movie. I think it holds up in almost every aspect.
You're not showing him Cobra Kai, are you?
What I did was I skipped to the tournament scene at the very end. We have not watched the ongoing story of Johnny and Daniel.
Okay.
Even though I am fascinated by that premise. But I showed him the tournament, you know, with the, you're the best around, you know, Esposito.
Oh, God. Are we in sports talk now with that music?
Yeah. Well, and I think what I'm trying to do is kind of like groom him to a point of wanting to watch other kung fu movies with me, which was at a point in my life, there was that I was very into that. I was very into like my Van Damme movies, old Schwarzenegger, pulling out old Bruce Lee movies, kind of find out what all that stuff's about.
Yep. So Kung Fu Panda?
Well, I've tried, but like he's not quite there. But he was enthralled by the ending of Karate Kid.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
So
Emma's first R-rated film was Enter the Dragon.
Oh, okay.
It was. Yeah. I was corrected because I thought her first one was Bridesmaids. I was there for both, but and it was like, well, Bridesmaids seems like a girl power and girl ensemble comedy, and then she's like, nah, Dad, you wanted me to really watch Enter the Dragon. And I went, okay, fine. Yeah. It was. And it was one of those, I think it was what I had talked about it enough. Mm-hmm. And we had seen Kung Fu Panda. And I think finally it just got the best of me. The other reason why we finally watched Jaws was that she'd watched Sharknado twice.
Okay.
One with riff tracks and one without. And I felt like I was lacking as a parent.
You're
so
right.
I think we were at this riff tracks one on a Thursday night. And I looked at her before the movie started, out of nowhere, I just went, Sunday we're watching Jaws.
Yeah.
And she went, okay, Dad, all right. So, I'd say start with Enter the Dragon.
Okay.
For a little one. Yeah, well, I would say Kung Fu Panda, then Enter the Dragon. But, you know, I see where you're going. Five Fingers of Death is soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm trying to just, like, remember which ones, bones are broken without like compound fractures. Things that I think might be like upsetting to
nobody's heart or throat
exactly.
is ripped out. You're not showing your Roadhouse anytime soon.
Just gentle violence, you know, just playful violence.
Just, you know, somebody is whacked in the neck and then they fall down and there's no blood. Yeah, we remember those. That's why ladies and gentlemen, it was a big deal with the spaghetti westerns in the 60s because at one time in Hollywood, the shooter and shootee could not be in the same frame.
Is that true?
That I believe that was because you know, and you know, that's why we had, and especially in TV, you know, shot of the person shooting,
sure.
Then cut to guy going, "Oh, you got me," turning, falling, so you just see no blood.
Okay,
but I think, especially like the first scene in or one of the opening scenes in Fistful of Dollars, where Clint's to the left and all the guys laughing at him are sitting on a fence on the right, and they were in the same frame, and boom, boom, boom. I think that was, you know, the taboos. That and the beatings were dirtier and dustier and a little more grittier in the Italian, in the spaghetti westerns,
yeah.
At that time, especially going up against at that time, you know, an aging John Wayne and mm-hmm. and Alvarez Kelly and some of the other studio, you know, you had besides the studio, the big studio musicals and period pieces that were failing, you know, there was also a lot of fairly expensive westerns that weren't doing all that great either. So, you know, there was morphing to from John Wayne to Clint Eastwood mm-hmm. for the kind of western antihero because there were no black or white hats. I mean, there were great aspects to John Wayne character. He was a flawed person, but not a, you know, certainly not an angel, but not as ambiguous as some of the guys in the Leone films. And in the case of like in Sergio Corbucci's Django, instead of the dusty tumbleweeds, it's cold and no, it's muddy and a lot of rain and a gunk, which is probably how Western towns were really like back then. Look at McCabe and Mrs. Miller, yeah. And The Great Silence, which was another Corbucci film, which was shot in the winter, which it's got to be a daunting task to try to shoot a Western in cold winter time. So, all right. So anyway. You have some tips, so there you go.
Yeah,
I would love to. Eventually, I'm going to get you both in here because that will be, and it won't be the dating game or the newlywed game.
Well, I don't know.
What do you mean? That was our first. No, she does not sound like that. You know, or it's if you know the newlywed game, you know, one person has the answer written on a card, and the other one gets it wrong and gets hit with the card. No, we're not doing that. So,
fair enough.
But all right, but Eric, I really, really appreciate you hanging out.
I thank you for having me on. I was happy to come by to discuss this film with you and learn about a few others.
And if you're up at Yats in Carmel, tell them Film Sociology sent you. You won't get anything out of it, but you'll get a smile from the staff. So, all right, ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!